in Brown County in New Ulm this morning for oral arguments. You will each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant, I'm not sure you're the appellant. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you each state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. We forgot to bring the clock along that would tick off your time, so we have low-tech clock there. You will see a sign when you have 5 minutes remaining, when you have 1 minute remaining, and then there will be an alarm when your time has expired. All right, with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gary Hogan, H-O-G-E-N. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellate defendant, Timothy Atkins. The case before this court has essentially four issues that were raised, three of which are still relevant. The first two are closely related. The third issue, the right to counsel, was decided by the Supreme Court in Rosenbusch. And I think at this point I have to concede that was very negative precedent for my position. My client was read the statutory language of 171.177, that refusal to take a test is a crime, and under Rosenbusch would not have a right to counsel in a criminal proceeding. That being said, the two other issues that are very closely related are the issues of whether or not the testing method used was within constitutional parameters. And the second issue that's very closely related is whether or not the refusal of the urine test needed a warrant. And I say they're closely related because both of them touch upon the same constitutional and statutory issues. With regards to the first issue, Minnesota Statute 169A.20, subdivision 2, defines refusal to submit to a chemical test as a crime. And in it, it states, it is a crime for any person to refuse to submit to a chemical test. And the first section deals with breath, and the second subdivision, or parentheses 2, deals with blood or urine states of a person's blood or urine as required by a search warrant under sections 171.177 and 626.04 and 626.18. With regards to the second issue, the trial court found that 171.177, the requirement that when an individual is asked to give a blood test, it's not a refusal until they also refuse the urine test. The trial court essentially found that does not apply in a criminal proceeding. It would be our position it does apply. And
so tell me what happened here. The warrant was for blood, if I understand.
Yep.
And I'm sure you'll talk about the circumstances under which the blood draw was attempted, but ultimately your client said, nope, not taking the blood test. And then didn't the officer offer a urine test?
Yes.
And he said no to that as well.
He said no to that as well.
So why, it seems like that just falls exactly under the provisions of 171.177 subdivision 2.
It does, with a couple of exceptions, and that is there was no warrant for a urine test.
But does there have to be?
I would argue that under State v. Thompson, yes. In order for an individual to be charged with the crime of refusal, they have to, there has to be a warrant. And that's what State v. Thompson basically says. That is under the old law prior to 171.177. And in response McNeely versus Missouri, but in order for there to be a crime of refusal, there needs to be a warrant.
That's only successful if you're successful on your first issue.
That is correct.
Okay.
Because that issue only comes up, well, yes. Yes, those two are related. Because the judge essentially found that this issue I'm talking about right now, the second issue, doesn't apply at all.
Okay.
That's what the trial court essentially found.
So what you're arguing is if you're successful on the first argument, that the second would not be a refusal because there was no warrant for that.
That is correct.
Okay.
That any time an officer asks, and it's still an open question, because I think, but it's not an issue in this case, Minnesota Statute 171.177 essentially removes the traditional warrant requirement from the DWI process in that officers are required to follow that now. But that's not an issue in this case. And I think that that will be an issue that will be coming up in the future is do officers, can they do the traditional way when the statute says this is what you must do to get a urine test? And the refusal itself, 169.80 subdivision 2, the refusal prior specifically puts 171.177 in it for it to be a crime of refusal. And so my position is all of 171.177 is integrated into the criminal statute. Trial court essentially found that, you know, it always says blood or urine, therefore the urine doesn't apply. And it also says no action shall be taken. And I don't know that that, you know, the trial court essentially said, I don't know that that then applies it to the criminal case. But I think criminal statutes are to be strictly construed, and the wording of refusal to submit to chemical test crime does include that statute. It doesn't leave any part of it out.
It seems to me the critical part of 171.177 is that there be a warrant for either blood or urine, which we had here.
Yes.
Okay.
There was a warrant for blood.
Right, but it's stated in the alternative. There was. It says there has to be a warrant for either blood or urine, and there was blood, a warrant for blood. Okay, and so then you go on and you say if the person refuses the blood test, it's not a refusal crime unless you then offer them after that refusal the option to take the urine test.
Yes.
It just seems to me that the provisions of the statute were exactly met here. Why am I wrong? Or are you really trying to challenge the statute itself?
It's our position that under State v. Thompson, you can't ask for either a urine or a blood test without a warrant in Minnesota.
So you need every warrant needs to request both?
If you're going to be requesting the urine. Obviously, if it's a blood test, my guy takes the test. That provision doesn't apply because it took the blood test. But any time a urine or a blood test is requested, yes. And I think that's why the trooper testified, you know, in their training, they're told to get both, and they always get both. And I would assume this case is a real anomaly in that the warrant only requested blood test. Because things happen and things become unavailable. And particularly where there was a situation where the DMT was not available. But it would be our position that the holding of Thompson still applies, even to a urine case, even to a urine test, a warrant is required for the criminal charge of refusal. And that would be our position. And I know that seems...
Even though there was the warrant for the blood test.
There was a warrant for a blood test. There was not a warrant for a urine test. And why that was done, I don't know. No explanation was given. I assume the officer just didn't put them both in. I would assume the form they had would request both. I don't know how that happened. The evidence in the record does not indicate why it happened that way. But that's the way it was done. I don't think... The Thompson case gets me pushed aside just because there was a warrant for the blood. Because the statutory requirements of 626.04 to 626.18, you know, there's always an issue of whether or not that could lead to suppression. Well, the statute says if you violate it, it has to be followed. And it would be our position that a warrant has to specifically say what can be tested. Just like it has to specifically say what can be searched the house and what in the house.
So if he had just said no to blood and there had been no request for a urine test, you would have no suppression argument based on 177?
That would be the issue that I said is not before this court, and that is whether or not 171.177 requires that police officers use that statute at all times. And I think that goes to the history of what is traditionally called the plank and set laws. I still look at 171.177 as an implied consent law because what part of what it does, other than make room for the crime of refusal, is a person is given a choice to take a test or not take a test. They face consequences for that decision, license revocation and criminal consequences, and they face a pre-hearing revocation of their license. And so walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, does everything like a duck. It's essentially an implied consent statute that has been justified for decades. And, you know, calling it a warrant process statute doesn't change that.
Except for the statute, though, the defendant would have no right to refuse a test if there was a warrant. Correct?
Yes. And I, you know, I've been practicing.
So the statute actually provides an option.
The statute provides for a right for criminal defendants in Minnesota that no one, no citizen of this country has ever had. That is when you are presented with a warrant, you can say no. And that's a quandary. I think it was a quandary for the trial court. It was a quandary for the prosecutor. It's a quandary for everything.
Well, there's just something about sticking a needle in somebody that's different than walking into their house or opening their car.
Yes.
But isn't that exactly why the refusal to abide by that warrant comes with a consequence, whether it's a warrant for blood or urine, as the statute talks about?
Well, and, you know, and I would think that blood draws, I would rather be the urine sample. You know, the Railroad Association case, Skinner, essentially makes an argument that you have a larger privacy interest in a urine test than a blood test. And, you know, and but yes, either one, because I mean, theoretically, you know, if you refuse a urine test, they could catheterize you, which I suspect courts are looking at that too, although no one mentions it. You know, it's if a person doesn't give it, you'd be catheterized. So either, both of those tests are very intrusive. I'm running out of time, so I'd like to get to the first issue, and that's the issue of whether or not the warrant was executed in a reasonable manner. There's really no longer a reasonable refusal on defense, but in this case, it's very simple facts. My client, Mr. Atkins, is sitting in a holding cell. The officers state they give him a copy of a warrant in there, tell him that refusals to take a test is a crime. They also say it in the DMT room. He's taken to the DMT room for a blood draw. Now, the DMT room, as found by the court, is a room that's about 8 by 8. It's not a great big room. It's got a little divider in it. Behind that divider is a toilet, a sink, and a shower. It's essentially a bathroom with a DMT machine in it. Rather than take the test on the other side of that divider, my client was put in a white $15 Menards lawn chair next to the toilet, close enough that he could stick his hand into the toilet. One officer testified it was within a foot, and the trooper couldn't exactly recall, but he said yes, he could stick his hand into it. The trooper, who had done a total of 6 tests in this setting, you know, said he was trying to do with what he had. So it was that, and then placed in front of that chair was another chair, a cloth office chair. And on that cloth office chair was put all of the medical instruments to be used. And I know there are some states, Daggett in Wisconsin, where a blood was forcibly withdrawn by a doctor being held down by police, but, you know, flexing arms and everything, they were able to get a sample. But that's the facts here, and I don't think Minnesota has a history of giving that to people. I think the history of the implied consent law in Minnesota is real clear. We don't want police officers strapping people down to get a test, unless there's a criminal vehicle operation. Minnesota's been real clear. I think 171.177 even makes that more clear than the implied consent law does. You have to follow this procedure to get a warrant. It's a procedure that we don't want in Minnesota. And in this thing, our position is there isn't any case. There's really no case law on this where someone's trying to draw a blood sample next to a toilet. And there's just something that feels really wrong about that. And that's not what the implied consent law wanted police officers to do. And that's even going beyond the fact you had a 2-week course at Invergrove Hills Community College, and the statute only requires a course from a college, and so it technically is, because it was put on by 2 nurses, and you know, they couldn't find a hospital for the trooper to draw blood from. But in New Ulm, they actually let him do it, even though no other hospital would let him do it. You know, there's just something about that process that's wrong. Schmerber has probably been, over the last 5-6 decades, the most misinterpreted case there's ever been. I think McNeely versus Missouri shows that. And yes, it is dicta, but it's pretty strong dicta.
But there wasn't a warrant in Schmerber, right? I mean.
That is correct. And
you didn't have the trained lobotomist.
Right, and
those things.
Well, I think there was a doctor in Schmerber, was at hospital. But I mean, also, there wasn't an implied consent procedure that said, well, when someone refuses, you have to respect that. And defines a refusal the way it is in Minnesota clearly, that you could have objection to blood and do urine, or you could have objection to urine and do blood.
So what would you have the court state as the rule of law, that a warranted blood test has to be taken in a hospital? Is that what you're would be advocating for?
I'm advocating that not be taken next to a toilet. I mean, the holding cell would be a better choice. Other areas would be a better choice. I mean, I would advocate it should be taken in a law enforcement center by an individual with a state trooper's uniform on, with five or six other officers and guns in an 8x8 room all sitting there watching the blood draw. It has no semblance of a medical procedure at that point. I think my time is run. Thank you.
You will
so
have
you're advocating that a police officer should not be taking the blood draw?
A fully licensed or a fully uniformed police officer with a gun, yes. I mean, I think that kind of goes against the statutory purpose that Minnesota has since the 1980s and before, when implied consent laws were found, that we don't want confrontation between police officers and private citizens that can turn physical.
All right, thank you. You will have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for responding.
Good morning. My name is Shannon Ness. I am representing the state. There were four main issues, as counsel conceded, that Rosenbusch favored the state. I will not argue on the preliminary test right to counsel amendments to the Constitution. However, the other issues are whether by refusing to submit to a blood draw required by the warrants and subsequently offer the urine test, whether this constitutes a refusal. The second issue is whether appellant's testing conditions are reasonable. And the third issue is whether the officer impermissibly expanded the stop by opening the appellant's door. By refusing to submit to blood tests required by the warrant, appellant did refuse to submit to chemical testing under Minnesota Statute 169-820, Subdivision 2. The fact that appellant was offered a urine test after he refused a blood test required by the warrant does not change the fact that appellant refused to submit to chemical testing.
How about, does the State versus Thompson case, which Attorney Hogan cited to us repeatedly, I mean, how does that impact 171.177?
I think with my case, it does not impact it. The statute says it is a crime for any person to submit to a chemical test. The request of a blood test is a chemical test, and at the end of the day, appellant refused to submit to a blood test, which was required by the warrant.
But he refused also to submit to a urine test, and this warrant didn't reference urine. It was just blood. Does State versus Thompson, notwithstanding the enactment of what is now 171.177, does Thompson still require that there have been a warrant for that alternative urine test? And why not?
I don't think so. As Tran pointed out, a urine test is less intrusive than a blood test. The warrant required that the defendant or the appellant submit to a blood test. And that's simply a test. And in the or a chemical test. In the statute it says or. It's blood or urine. Additionally, a urine test is less intrusive. Therefore, it goes to reason that if the courts or if the neutral magistrate found that there was probable cause for a blood test, it goes to reason that there was also probable cause for a less intrusive urine test.
Would your argument change if we disagree with your characterization of a urine test as less intrusive?
It doesn't, because there was probable cause for a blood test. And that, it seems like in this case that the failure of the officer to request both a urine and a blood test was a clerical error. That's what it seems like. And therefore, that shouldn't be held against the state, first of all. But second of all, the fact that there was probable cause for a chemical test is enough for there to require both a blood or a urine test. Moving on to the second issue, the testing conditions were reasonable. Appellant was placed in a sanitary holding cell and was asked to submit to testing. First, he did not submit to testing. Therefore, the argument that appellant was subject to unsanitary conditions is flawed. Second, there's simply nothing.
Counsel, if he had actually gone through with the testing, it would have been in that environment. So it seems like you're asking us to ignore what the situation when the warrant required a blood test and the police were going to take the blood in that particular situation. So how does that situation not present an unreasonable environment for testing?
Well, there's nothing on the record to indicate that the environment was unsanitary, first of all. Secondly, there's nothing on the record to suggest that he refused because he thought it was unsanitary, or he refused because he was in fear of some infection or in fear of pain. There's nothing on the record to suggest that. Schmerer versus California, as the appellant cites in his brief, has been interpreted broadly by multiple jurisdictions. While these interpretations are not binding on this court, they do provide some guidance. Further, the trial court found that the trooper was a trained phlebotomist and that he was qualified to take these blood draws, and he had done so in this exact same room, in this exact same position, multiple times. There was no reports of infection or anything like that. Therefore, this is not unreasonable conditions. Finally, the officer did not impermissibly expand the scope of the stop when he opened the door of the vehicle. Here, the officer's actions were related to the stop's original purpose. The officer had observed multiple driving behaviors, and based on his training and experience, this led him to believe that the appellant was under the influence of alcohol or a controlled substance, whatever it may be. And after performing a traffic stop on the appellant's vehicle, the officer walked up to the vehicle, noticed the appellant was fumbling around with buttons, was unable to roll down the window, and after waiting 8 seconds, he opened the door.
Doesn't the record show that the passenger's window was open?
The passenger's window was open. The officer walked to the driver's side, and the driver's side window was not open.
So why not just go over to the other side of the vehicle and talk to the driver through the passenger's window?
I guess I can't answer
Or why is it reasonable to open the door in a situation where the passenger's window is open?
Because he saw the driver, who was the person he was worried about as he was driving the vehicle. He saw him fumbling, and in the totality of the circumstances, had reason to believe that he was under the influence, that he couldn't even open his own window.
There was nothing in the record that suggested the officer was concerned that Mr. Atkins was in need of medical assistance or anything like that.
No.
All right, so that distinguishes this case from the Overig case that you rely on in your brief, correct?
It would, yes. Based on these arguments and facts, the state would request that appellant's conviction be confirmed.
Let me ask this. Is there any reason we shouldn't require a medical-like environment for a drop of blood?
I think that would be a very big burden on law enforcement to require them every single time to take a defendant or a suspect to a medical provider to get blood drawn.
We're not talking necessarily about taking them to a medical provider, but providing a medical-like environment.
Again, I think the same argument would go to that issue as well. Would the law enforcement center have to add on to their building to have a medical-like environment for blood draws? That's a very big commitment.
Blood draw is a pretty big commitment, too.
I would argue that under the circumstances, you know, if there's a trained person to take blood and if the environment is sanitary, there's no reason that a blood draw can't be taken. I guess, for example, I've given my blood multiple times. There is a trained phlebotomist, and it's not in a medical area. Sometimes they're in just a building that's available, and this is a very similar situation.
But not a toilet.
I'm sorry?
But not a toilet.
I'm sorry.
But you didn't get blood in a toilet.
Oh, it wasn't in a toilet. And there's nothing on the record that suggests the defendant was reaching behind him in the toilet, or no one was flushing the toilet, and it's just under the circumstances, it was just a sanitary, or there's nothing in the record to show that it was not unsanitary. And I guess that's my argument regarding that.
Anything further? Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hogan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll try to keep my rebuttal very brief and try to make it points of clarification rather than rebuttal. And this goes to Judge Smith's question to me, and I think it kind of boils the whole issue down with regards to the warrant. Which refusal is the refusal under the refusal statute? Is it the blood test or the urine test? Our position is it's the urine test. The state's position is it's the blood test. And I think following the statute, 169A.20 subdivision 2, perhaps 2, perhaps all of 171.177 is incorporated. And all of 626.04 to 626.18 is incorporated, which is a big change in the law. That to be a crime of refusal, the state has to comply with all of the warrant requirements. Because normally in criminal cases, that's an argument. Well, does failure to comply with this part really lead to suppression? Under this statute, it's our position that the statute specifically incorporates it. That means the legislature determined the law incorporates it. And that is not left for judicial interpretation. And with regards to the point of, you know, no one knows what the conditions are. There's a person making a decision next to a toilet in a bathroom with a shower, where people throw up and do all sorts of things happen in there. Nothing good. Everyone in there is drunk. With regards to resources and burdens on the government, the video of this place made it clear. There's five officers sitting in a room. The record also makes it clear. One officer could have drove 8 blocks to a hospital. It took a lot more resources to do it this way. And I know
is there any indication on the record that he asked to go to a hospital?
No, he did not ask to go to the hospital. But it is in the record that was an option available, and the judge found his fact and was waiting 12 blocks away to the hospital. It's just it took a lot more resources to do this procedure the way it was done than the other way. I think that officers, you know, wanted to see it or whatever, I don't know. But, you know, that kind of removes it from being a medical procedure, which means people got it. The other thing about it, you know, the officer said in his training, all of his draws were done in a chair, and he was trying to get as close as he could to that with what he had. Well, I think that goes against the officer's own training. There's a reason blood draws are done in blood draw chairs. That's so the arms are in the right position. There's a reason when you go to get your blood drawn, they don't pull up a cloth office chair and set all the instruments on it. It's usually on a sterilized metal tray. And no, we can't prove that there was contamination, but I think it's reasonable to assume there very well was. or a person should...
Or could have been, there was no test, so...
Or a person should be apprehensive. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.